A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He came across a streamer named Clavicula, who visited Israel and wound up getting confronted in the Tel Aviv nightclub for singing an anti-Semitic song. The crowd held him to account, his audience ate up his content, and Daniel found himself staring into this whole toxic ecosystem of live streaming, looks maxing, and far-right hate movements. His question is basically, how did this world even get going? What corners of the internet are propagating it? And where's the counter-movement for wholesome content? Because he sees this stuff risking a tidal wave of backlash that takes down the whole apparatus.
He's not wrong to worry about that. The clavicular incident is almost too perfect as an entry point. You've got a guy live-streaming himself in a foreign country, doing something deliberately provocative, getting a reaction, and that reaction becomes the product. The confrontation is the content.
Which is the whole business model in one scene. He's not traveling to learn anything or connect with anyone. He's farming reactions.
And to understand why that business model works the way it does, we have to talk about looks maxing. Because clavicular didn't just emerge from nowhere. He's part of a pipeline.
Let's define that term, because I think most people hear looks maxing and assume it's just another fitness trend. It's not.
It's really not. Looks maxing is a subculture obsessed with maximizing physical attractiveness through extreme methods. We're talking specialized grooming routines, cosmetic surgery, posture training, even things like mewing, which is this tongue posture technique that's supposed to reshape your jawline over time. But the ideology behind it originated in incel forums, specifically sites like incels.is and looksmax.me. The foundational premise isn't just, I want to look better. It's, my physical appearance is the sole determinant of my social and romantic worth, and society has rigged the game against me because of how I look.
It's self-improvement built on a scaffolding of resentment.
And that's the distinction that most mainstream coverage misses. When a 15-year-old boy searches how to get a sharper jawline on YouTube or TikTok, the algorithm doesn't distinguish between a dermatologist's advice and a looks-maxing video that ends with, and here's why women won't date you unless your Cantal tilt is positive. The angle of your eye. It's one of their obsessions. They measure everything. Wrist circumference, shoulder-to-waist ratio, the distance between your upper lip and your nose. And all of this gets scored and ranked in these forums with a vocabulary that's entirely their own. Terms like mogging, which is when one person's appearance supposedly dominates another's just by standing near them. Soft maxing is the non-surgical stuff. Hard maxing is surgery. And then there's bone smashing.
I'm almost afraid to ask.
Bone smashing is when teenagers hit themselves in the face with hard objects, supposedly to create microfractures that heal and build up bone density in the jaw and cheekbones. There are videos, thousands of them, with millions of views.
We've arrived at a point where kids are taking hammers to their own faces because a forum told them it would make them more attractive. And this isn't some dark corner of the web nobody sees. This is on TikTok.
It's mainstream. The terminology has leaked completely. You'll hear teenagers use words like mogging and softmaxing on Instagram and not have any idea they're quoting incel forums. It's like how people use gaslighting without knowing it came from a 1940s film. Except the source material here is a community built on misogyny and racial hierarchy.
That's pillar one, the aesthetic insecurity engine. What about pillar two, the live streaming layer?
This is where the platform mechanics get specific and kind of grim. Over the last few years, platforms like Kick and Rumble have positioned themselves as alternatives to Twitch and YouTube by offering looser moderation policies. Kick in particular built its reputation on taking streamers who'd been banned elsewhere. They pay based on watch time and donations, which means the incentive structure rewards anything that keeps viewers glued to the screen.
Nothing keeps people glued like watching someone have a public meltdown or get confronted in a nightclub.
That's the attention economy in its purest form. a guy calmly touring a museum generates a fraction of the watch time of a guy getting chased out of a bar. The platform doesn't care about the content's nature, it cares about the minutes. And live chat adds another layer. When Clavicular is streaming from Tel Aviv, his chat is scrolling in real time, egging him on, daring him to do more, rewarding him with donations when he escalates. It's a feedback loop where the most extreme voices set the tone, and the streamer, who's performing for an audience that's also his income source, follows where the incentives lead.
The commenters themselves are getting radicalized in real time. You're watching alongside hundreds or thousands of other people, all of whom are typing the same slurs, the same in-jokes, the same ideological shorthand. It normalizes the thing through sheer repetition and social proof.
There's a clinical parallel here. In my years practicing pediatrics, I saw how group dynamics in adolescent peer groups could normalize behaviors that any individual kid would have rejected on their own. The difference is that a live stream chat isn't six friends behind the bleachers. It's thousands of strangers, it's permanent, and it's algorithmically amplified.
Let's put this together. Looks maxing provides the insecurity. It tells you your face is your destiny, and you've already lost the genetic lottery. Live streaming provides the audience and the financial incentive. And then far-right ideology provides the scapegoating narrative. It's not your fault. It's women, or immigrants, or Jews, or society. Someone rigged the game.
That's the convergence. And it's not accidental. The pipeline is engineered. To understand how it works, we need to look under the hood at three specific platform mechanisms.
Walk me through them.
First mechanism, the algorithmic amplification of insecurity. TikTok and YouTube Shorts use recommendation engines that are extraordinarily good at detecting what keeps a user watching. If a teenage boy shows interest in fitness content, the algorithm starts serving adjacent material, and the adjacency between how to do a proper push-up and why your jawline determines your entire future is very short. A few videos in, and the feed shifts from self-improvement to self-loathing, from self-loathing to resentment, from resentment to ideology.
The kid didn't search for any of this. He searched for push-ups.
And the algorithm, optimized entirely for engagement, learned that teenage boys who watch fitness content will also watch looks maxing content, and that looks maxing viewers will also watch content about how society is rigged against them, and that those viewers will watch anti-feminist content, and so on. The funnel builds itself because the data shows that outrage and insecurity keep people scrolling.
The algorithm isn't neutral. It's actively constructing a path from fitness to extremism. Not because anyone programmed it to do that, but because the engagement metrics lead there.
That's the thing critics get wrong. Nobody at these companies sat in a boardroom and said, "Let's radicalize teenagers." They said, "Maximize watch time." And the data told them that radicalization content maximizes watch time. The outcome is the same, but the mechanism is more insidious because it's emergent. The live streaming attention economy. Kick, Rumble, YouTube Live. They pay based on metrics that reward duration and intensity. A streamer who does a calm, informative 2-hour broadcast about architecture gets a fraction of what a streamer earns by provoking confrontations for 6 hours. The Clavicular Israel stream is a perfect case study. He's not there to experience the country. He's there to perform for an audience that rewards provocation. The nightclub confrontation wasn't an accident, it was the product. And the fact that people in Israel saw through his "I'm just a friendly traveler" routine and held him accountable, that itself became content for his audience back home. Accountability becomes entertainment.
He gets to play the victim and the provocateur simultaneously. His audience sees him as a truth-teller being persecuted, and the confrontation validates their worldview.
And the economics reinforce it. A streamer who never gets confronted, who never cries on camera, who never has a public breakdown, is leaving money on the table. The incentives don't just permit toxicity, they require it. The comment section as radicalization engine. Live chat isn't like a standard comment section where you post and walk away. It's real time. The streamer reads it, reacts to it, amplifies it. The most extreme comments get the most attention because they're the most noticeable. And when a streamer laughs at a hateful comment or nods along with it, that's a social reward. The commenter feels seen. Others in the chat see that being extreme gets you noticed. The behavior escalates.
It's operant conditioning. The most outrageous thing gets the biggest reward.
It happens at a speed that makes moderation nearly impossible. You can't moderate a live stream the way you moderate a forum. By the time a human moderator has reviewed a hateful comment, it's already been on screen, the streamer's already reacted to it, and hundreds of people have already seen it. The harm is done in seconds.
You've got three mechanisms, all reinforcing each other. The algorithm funnels insecure teenagers toward extremist content. The attention economy pays streamers to escalate. And the live chat provides real-time social rewards for hate speech. Each one would be a problem on its own. Together, they're a machine.
That machine doesn't just stay on the screen. It produces knock-on effect in the real world. Bone smashing is the most literal example. Kids are physically injuring themselves based on pseudoscience they absorb from a looks-maxing video. But there are broader effects, too. The terminology itself has leaked into mainstream culture. I mentioned mogging earlier. You now have millions of teenagers using these words, internalizing these frameworks, without any awareness that they're quoting communities built on racial hierarchy and misogyny.
It's the linguistic equivalent of a Trojan horse. The word seems harmless, so you use it, and using it normalizes the conceptual framework it came from.
The framework is what matters. The looks-maxing worldview divides humanity into genetic winners and losers. It teaches that your worth is determined by millimeter measurements of your facial features. And once you accept that premise, the next step is almost inevitable. If worth is genetic, then some groups are inherently superior. If you've lost the genetic lottery, someone must be to blame. The pipeline from my Kenthal tilt is negative, to society is rigged against me, to here's who's rigging it is very short.
Daniel mentioned far-right hate movement specifically. How does that connection work?
It's a natural fit, ideologically. Far-right movements are built on biological determinism, racial hierarchy, and scapegoating. Looks-maxing provides the pseudoscientific framework for biological determinism. It gives you a vocabulary for ranking humans on supposedly objective physical criteria. From there, it's a small step to applying those rankings to ethnic groups, to nations, to civilizations.
The live streamers are the vector. They're the ones taking these ideas from obscure forums and broadcasting them to audiences of thousands in real time with donation incentives.
Clavicular is a case study in exactly this. He built an audience through looks-maxing content, then used that audience as a platform for increasingly explicit far-right messaging. The Israel trip wasn't random. It was targeted. And the nightclub incident, where he sang an anti-Semitic song and got confronted, that was the content his audience wanted.
What I find striking is that the people in that Tel Aviv nightclub did exactly the right thing. They saw through the I'm just a friendly traveler routine and held him accountable. But in the ecosystem we're describing, accountability is just more fuel.
That's the trap. Any response, positive or negative, is engagement. And engagement is the product. The only thing that starves this ecosystem is indifference. But indifference is hard to muster when someone is singing anti-Semitic songs in your local nightclub.
What happens when this stuff scales? Daniel's worried about a tidal wave of backlash that takes down the whole content creation apparatus. Is that realistic?
We're already seeing versions of it. In the last couple of years, major advertisers pulled spending from Rumble and Kick after hate speech controversies. The EU started enforcing the Digital Services Act against live streaming platforms specifically, targeting the real-time moderation failures we were just talking about. U.S. state legislatures have begun looking at live streaming regulation as a distinct category, separate from traditional social media.
Because the live nature creates a regulatory blind spot.
Pre-recorded content can be reviewed before publication. Live streams can't. And the legal frameworks we've built for content moderation assume a review process that simply doesn't exist in the live streaming context. Regulators are waking up to this, but they're years behind the technology.
The advertiser exodus. That's a real economic signal. But it cuts both ways, doesn't it? The platforms that lose advertisers over hate speech just pivot to donation-based models, which make the streamers even more dependent on their most extreme fans.
That's the paradox. Advertiser pullback doesn't kill the ecosystem. It makes it more insular. The streamer who loses ad revenue doubles down on direct donations from an audience that's already radicalized. The financial incentive to escalate actually increases.
The collateral damage hits legitimate creators who rely on the same platforms.
That's the backlash risk Daniel's worried about. When advertisers flee a platform, they don't just flee the hateful streamers, they flee everyone. The wholesome creators, the educational channels, the people building genuine communities, they all lose revenue because the platform's reputation has been contaminated by the worst actors on it.
Which brings us to his core question. Where's the movement for wholesome content?
It's just structurally disadvantaged. There are genuinely positive live streaming communities. The Study With Me streams, where someone just studies at a desk for hours and thousands of people study along with them. The Cozy Gaming streams, where the vibe is warmth and relaxation. Healthy Gamer GG, where a psychiatrist talks to gamers about mental health. The Yard podcast, which built a massive community around friends just being funny together without cruelty.
I've seen some of these. They're good, but they don't go viral the way a public confrontation goes viral.
They never will, because the engagement mechanics are fundamentally different. A wholesome stream generates steady, moderate engagement. An outrage stream generates spikes. The algorithm is optimized for spikes. A Study With Me stream might have 2,000 people watching quietly for 4 hours. A hateful confrontation stream might have 50,000 people watching for 20 minutes, but those 20 minutes generate more comments, more shares, more reactions, and more algorithmic promotion than the 4-hour study session ever will.
The game is rigged at the level of the metric.
The metric is the whole problem. As long as platforms optimize for engagement defined as any reaction, outrage will always beat kindness. You can't out-wholesome the hate machine. The wholesome content movement isn't losing because it's doing something wrong. It's losing because the playing field is tilted.
That doesn't mean it's hopeless. It means the counter strategy has to be different.
And this is where we can get practical. For creators, the most effective antidote to toxic live streaming isn't censorship, it's competition. Wholesome content needs to borrow the same engagement mechanics without the hate. Real-time interaction, community building, donation incentives, inside jokes, parasocial warmth. The difference is that the community is built around shared interests and genuine connection rather than shared enemies and grievance.
You're not just streaming. You're building a community that people want to belong to for positive reasons.
That's harder to build, but it's more durable. Hate communities burn hot and fast. They're built on a shared enemy, and when the enemy changes or the outrage fades, the community collapses. Positive communities built on shared interests last longer and are more resilient to platform changes.
What about for the average person who's not a creator, just someone trying to keep their feed from becoming a radicalization pipeline?
Active curation matters more than people think. The algorithm responds to negative feedback faster than positive. If you see looks maxing content, block the keywords. Looks maxing, black pill, mogging, bone smashing, all of them. Hit not interested aggressively. The recommendation engine will adjust within days. Most people just scroll past things they don't like without signaling, and the algorithm interprets passive viewing as interest.
Silence is read as consent by the machine.
If you watch 3 seconds of a looks-maxing video because you're horrified, the algorithm registers that as engagement and serves you more. You have to actively tell it no.
For parents or educators who might be listening, what's the red flag?
The shift from self-improvement to blame. A teenager watching videos about fitness or grooming or fashion is normal. That's been normal for decades. The red flag is when the content shifts from here's how to improve yourself to here's why your problems are someone else's fault. If the videos start talking about how society is rigged against certain people based on their appearance or how certain groups are responsible for the viewer's suffering, that's the pivot point. That's where self-improvement becomes radicalization.
The terminology is a tell, too. If you hear a kid using words like mogging or black pill or talking about canthal tilt, that vocabulary didn't come from a dermatologist. It came from incel forums.
The thing to understand, and this is where I think a lot of well-meaning adults get it wrong, is that the kid probably doesn't know that. They think they're learning about fitness and grooming. They have no idea they're being funneled toward extremism. So the response can't be, why are you watching this hateful content? It has to be, let me show you where these ideas actually come from.
That's a much harder conversation, but it's the one that might actually work.
It's the clinical approach. You don't shame a patient for their symptoms. You help them understand the underlying condition.
What do we do about the bigger picture? Daniel asks whether this whole apparatus can be reformed, or whether it's going to trigger a backlash that takes everything down with it.
I think the backlash is already happening, and it's taking multiple forms. You've got the regulatory response, which is slow but real. The EU Digital Services Act is forcing platforms to take real-time moderation seriously. You've got the advertiser response, which is faster but messier and hurts legitimate creators. And you've got the cultural response, which is people like the crowd in that Tel Aviv nightclub saying, no, we're not going to tolerate this in our actual physical spaces.
The cultural response feeds the content machine.
And that's the bind. There's no clean solution. But I think the most promising direction is the one Daniel is implicitly asking for. Building up the wholesome alternative. Not trying to tear down the toxic stuff, which just generates more engagement, but making the positive stuff so compelling that it wins on its own terms.
Even if the algorithm is tilted against it.
Because algorithms change. What doesn't change is that humans want genuine connection. The hate communities are offering a counterfeit version of it. The wholesome communities are offering the real thing. Over the long run, the real thing has an advantage. It's just that the long run is very long, and in the meantime, a lot of teenagers are hitting themselves in the face with hammers.
There's one more thing coming that makes all of this more complicated.
AI-generated streamers.
We're already seeing the beginnings of it. AI avatars that can live stream indefinitely, that never sleep, that can interact with chat in real time. By the end of this decade, the line between an authentic toxic streamer and a manufactured one will be essentially invisible. And a manufactured streamer can be optimized purely for engagement. No conscience, no limits, no accountability.
The clavicular incident will look quaint by comparison. Imagine a streamer who doesn't exist, generated entirely by AI, designed to provoke maximum outrage, streaming 24/7 in 100 languages simultaneously across every platform. That's not science fiction. The technology exists in prototype now.
The window for getting a handle on this is narrower than it looks.
Which is why Daniel's instinct is right. The wholesome counter-movement isn't just a nice-to-have, it's essential infrastructure for the next phase of the internet.
What do we actually tell people to do?
First, if you're a creator, build community around shared interests, not shared enemies. Borrow the engagement mechanics of live streaming, the real-time interaction, the inside jokes, the donation incentives, but point them toward connection rather than grievance. Second, if you're a platform user, curate aggressively. Block keywords, use not interested, and understand that passive viewing is interpreted as endorsement by the algorithm. Third, if you're a parent or educator, learn the vocabulary. Know what mogging and black pill and bone smashing mean. Not to police kids, but to have informed conversations about where these ideas come from and what they lead to.
The bigger structural stuff, the regulatory and platform design questions, those are being fought right now in Brussels and Sacramento, and in the policy teams at every major platform. The outcome is uncertain. But the individual actions matter too. They're what we can control.
The crowd in that Tel Aviv nightclub couldn't fix the algorithm, but they could say no in their own space. Not because it stops the content machine, it doesn't, but because it establishes that there's a world outside the screen where different rules apply, where singing an anti-Semitic song in public gets you thrown out, not rewarded.
That's the tension at the heart of this. The platforms reward what the real world rejects. As long as that gap exists, there's money to be made in bridging it.
Closing the gap means either the platforms change their incentives, or the real world changes its standards. I'd rather bet on the platforms changing.
Eventually they will. The question is, how many kids get hurt in the meantime? And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, scientists discovered a bacterium in the Gobi Desert that survives by turning its cell membrane into a prism, splitting sunlight into specific wavelengths it can use for energy, while reflecting the rest as a shimmering iridescent sheen visible from several meters away.
A bacterium with a prismatic cell membrane shimmering in the Gobi.
Nature's been doing looks maxing longer than we have.
I don't think that's the takeaway, but thank you, Hilbert. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through.
Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.